Thank you, Steve. Good morning, everyone. Good to see many familiar faces and have everybody back for quite a full event after COVID. So this morning we have a great panel of two managers and someone very involved on the risk side to talk about the parametric, the world of parametrics, and what we should be doing in cat bonds, which the panel before discussed a little bit that's happened historically. We haven't seen quite as much in recent days, but there's certainly a lot of discussion around it. So to kick us off, I think the panelists are probably known to many of you, but we have Lorenzo Volpi from Leadenhall Capital. We have Niels Ossenbrink from 12 Capital. And then we have Michael Bennett from the World Bank. So to let them introduce their organizations, I thought for our first question to have you all speak a little bit about how you think about parametric risk at your organization in today's context.
Okay, thanks, Maria. Good morning, everyone. So Lorenzo Volpi of Leadenhall Capital Partners. We are London-based asset manager. We're also an office in Bermuda. We manage around $6 billion between non-life and life and alternative credit now. When we look at parametric, obviously, you know, we have a number of funds. Each fund has different investment targets and risk criteria that we need to meet. Parametric triggers are obviously welcome. They're just part of one of the triggers that are available in the insurance market to transfer risk. Obviously, they are very important. We heard it from Mike earlier about, you know, ESG and also the importance of bringing new type of risk to the market. Obviously, diversification is the angle. Modeling is important. You know, there are probably two main modeling firms, AIR and RMS, and I'm sure, you know, Michael will comment on that, that they've been trying to look at different modeling firms for different type of perils in order to increase the penetration of insurance risk in the market. But overall, obviously, premium is also important. I mean, ultimately, you need to be paid for the risk, and also the type of trigger, whether it's binary or whether it could be, you know, maybe within a range so that you don't lose 100% of your capital, also has an important factor when we look at this type of triggers.
Yes. Yeah, Niels Ossenbrink from 12. definitely not so well known to the crowd. It's the first time that, that I'm on one of these panels. But I'm really glad to be here and also listen to Michael and the presentation before, since it really gave me a good overview on what happened 25 years ago when I was still in the banking and asset management industry. And this is where we are coming from at 12. So we are an asset manager, and that's the way we address the parametric risk solution and address the overall topic of ILS. We strongly believe that the success of the future of ILS, of CAT, is really depending on giving back the trust and confidence to the investor base. If you go over the last 25 years, it was a great story, great growth, but post 2017, I think many investors, many of our clients are disappointed. However, the overall need and necessity and interest for investors for such an interesting asset class is there. I think it's on us to develop it, to get it done. And I heard a couple of times the word parametric. We believe for an institutional investor or other investors, it's an ideal solution. It's really something which we should try to grow. On the other side, we clearly see that there are some still stumbling block mismatches which we have to overcome. And I don't think that parametric is as such the solution. I think you just said it. We need the right modeling, we need the right pricing, we need the right risk assessment. And if we get this done, I think we can really prosper and we can get back to growth in our industry. And that's where we at 12 like to contribute and support the development.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, everybody. First of all, I want to thank Steve for the invitation, and also we use Artemis as our main source of information in this market, so really appreciate what Artemis does. We also use Artemis as our main communication tool with investors broadly. So when we have a payout, either a payout that's going to happen or we find out a deal's not going to pay out, we want the whole market to know at one time so that nobody has a trading advantage. And we use Steve very much as a dissemination agent for that kind of information because we know everyone checks the website. So thank you very much for your work, Steve, in this area. What we're doing at the World Bank Treasury is ensuring our sovereign members against certain disaster risk, primarily hurricane and earthquake to date, but we also did a deal in pandemic and certainly drought and flood or other risks we look at. So we're writing an insurance policy to a sovereign government, and we're turning around and hedging that risk in the market, either by issuing a cat bond, potentially writing, buying reinsurance. And in doing that, what we're usually doing is insuring the Ministry of Finance of a government. So the Ministry of Finance is insuring its fiscal position in the event of a disaster. So Parametric really works optimally for that. We couldn't do an indemnity deal for Ministry of Finance because their losses are so varied and so difficult to determine up front. A lot of the loss is simply reallocation of budget resources. So a big event occurs and the Ministry of Finance will suddenly have to reallocate budget from education, from health, and put it into disaster recovery. So that's what we're insuring. And when you're insuring those kind of losses, an indemnity transaction really isn't appropriate. It really is a parametric solution is what we need. We also are generally insuring governments against what we call emergency losses, or the losses immediately post-disaster, not recovery, because the market's just not big enough to fund recovery. What we're looking at is funding emergency losses. And when you're doing that, you want quick payouts. So we couldn't wait 6 months or a year for a payout to come in once a loss assessment is made. We need a quick payout. So again, Parametric is the perfect solution for us. We've done about $3 billion of cat bonds since we started this. And all of those have been in Parametric in one way or another, either pure Parametric or a Parametric modeled loss transaction. And we think, having done now $3 billion, it's worked quite well. It's some deals have triggered, but they've only triggered when you'd expect. And we've, in fact, had two deals in our history that have triggered for full payouts. One was a pandemic bond, which was triggered for COVID. And I don't think any investor could say COVID wasn't a big enough deal to trigger something. So we had a full payout for a COVID bond. We also had a full payout on one tranche of a Mexican earthquake bond, which was also a very large devastating earthquake in Mexico. So we think the transactions we've done have worked theoretically well for the government, and have worked well in practice. They've triggered when you'd expect them to be triggered. They haven't triggered when you wouldn't expect. So we think it's been a very successful experience, and we definitely want to do more.
Actually, Michael, this brings to mind the cat swap rather than the cat bond that we structured back in 2007 for the Caribbean. It was the first multi-state pool, risk pool. And I think that triggered more than 40 times. I was actually reading the other day, which is quite, unbelievable. Now, not big amounts, but it did what it was to do. And to your point, the parametric trigger obviously helps in terms of the speed of payout, but also mitigate the asymmetry of information. I think I remember when we structured that deal, there were a lot of concern among investors or our insurers like Swiss Re and Munich Re about how should we make sure that each of the islands would report the right amount of losses. And it was quite funny and embarrassing to be in Miami with a number of ministers from different islands, everyone claiming that they would have the biggest banana crop compared to his peer. And if there was an event, they would have lost X amount of millions. And of course, for me, it was difficult to say, well, I'm not sure how many people will trust you when you come and say, this is how much we lost following this hurricane. And that's why we came out with this parametric index where we gave a weight to each of the different islands. And since then, actually, the other problem we faced, I think one of the first triggers was for an earthquake in Haiti. And I remember that we got criticized because obviously you get a lot of media coverage, and it was a true disaster, unfortunately, but the payout was limited to the insured amount, which was quite low. It was, if I remember well, it was only $5 million. And of course, everyone started screaming and say, oh, but is this enough for them? How come we only bought $5 million? Which again goes back to the point of how do we help these frontier markets or emerging markets to actually get more penetration of insurance, because ultimately they always want to pay a very low premium. They always expect to get payback if, you know, they, and I know that you always have to spend a lot of time negotiating, you know, with the different governments in terms of the, you know, how to set the trigger and to make sure that they get some payout, or which,
well, yeah, we get this, this is not very political correct person to reference, but there's an old Woody Allen joke where he says, the food in this restaurant's terrible, and the portions are too small. And we get that reaction all the time with our deals, because people say, before any trigger happens, they say, this was horrible. Why are you having a country pay for insurance? And in fact, often it is a donor paying, so it's not the country paying. But why are you paying for insurance when there's other priorities? Then an event happens, the insurance pays out, and people say, the portions are too small. You know, why didn't you, you know, it was the dumbest thing in the world to do, but why didn't you do 10 times more of it? So we definitely have that. That's a big, you know, issue with any of our transactions.
So maybe picking up on that thread, I mean, what, you've talked about some deals that have worked very well, the $3 billion that you did, Michael, but what, I mean, what would kind of unlock this market and unlock access to that risk beyond finding somebody to pay for it, Lorenzo?
Well, you need the, it's tough. First of all, you need more people focusing on structuring those deals. I think, you know, when I think about frontier markets and emerging markets, if I'm not wrong, I think it's only the World Bank, right, that it's involved. There is no one else that is really pushing that market. You need more volumes at the same time as well. So I do face some investors that, you know, talk about ESG, and they would love to see more bonds that tick the trigger and that tick the box in terms of increasing penetration or you know, diminishing this gap. However, they say, well, you know, for me to be meaningful, we need to put at work at least 200, 300 million. How big is this market so far? So when you look at the carbon market, I mean, if you include some of the state pools as well, not just frontier markets and emerging markets, then you don't reach the 1 billion in a $38 billion market. So obviously, that's not much, right? Then if you try to do a dedicated fund for an investor, you also need to promise that you will be able to scale it up quite quickly. But of course, you know, the World Bank cannot promise to be able to come to market with all these deals together. So we need more people. And I think, I mean, we are in the right direction, right? I keep reading publication from Swiss Re and Munich Re in terms of how big is this gap, which it's quoted about 1.4 trillion when you include property cat, health, and mortality risk. Obviously, it's narrowing, but it's still very big. You know, it's around probably 70%, so there is a lot that needs to be done. Obviously, you know, in the penetration should increase in line with the GDP of the world, and I know insurance is a big industry, and I see now a lot of the primary insurance companies as well that are lobbying, you know, the AXA, the Generali, the Allianz, and so on, in order to, you know, there is much more awareness, there are more discussion with the United Nations as well, so, you know, hopefully we are on the right path, but there is still a lot of work to be done, I think.
Yeah, I think this is these ambitions of the World Bank are great, and I think you mentioned one topic which I think is crucial in this whole discussion is that the parametric solutions for your partners are the ideal solution, and I think very often, probably in the past, was not be the case for the various parametric solutions. You were fighting during hard markets, soft markets, against traditional more different indemnity type of triggers, and these were probably not ideal for some players. And so the ILS market was competing. So I wasn't there in this industry then, but if I see the whole discussion now, and I saw it at the beginning, it's also something which we probably focus on more than others at 12, but I see the big discussion here now. And I believe part of this discussion is not happening in this room. I think part of the discussion is happening with other players, which are probably more fintech-oriented, maybe younger, more digitized, and which are not probably coming from the traditional insurance reinsurance industry world by nature. Probably they see this and they identify probably solutions for problems which are probably related to climate, which are probably better suited for parametric solutions. So I think we will see, hopefully, additional growth in this industry in other areas than in the traditional areas. I think there is potential, and when I listen to the discussions and when I read Artemis and other publications, there is obviously going on a lot to go more towards parametric in the more traditional world, but I also see a lot of developments from startups, from fintechs, from other people rethinking this, and I think this is relevant. Having a full value chain from the beginning, to the end, I think then it makes sense. But stepping in a traditional kind of process and just changing the trigger at the end in order to make it nicer for the institutional investor, I don't believe that this can work.
I'm just thinking about that, but let me go back to what I was already going to say, because that's easier for my brain to handle. Definitely, we have a number of challenges. We have almost 190 member countries at the World Bank, and all of them are, 95% of them are highly vulnerable to one natural disaster or another. So we're only scratching the surface of what we can do. Now, the biggest single challenge we have is nothing to do with you folks. It's on our origination side. It's talking to our member governments to convince them insurance is a good idea for at least their most severe storm risk. It's not the only idea. It's certainly not the only thing they should be doing, but it is a good tool to have. That's really difficult for poor countries. Now, really poor countries like Haiti, we're never going to ask them to pay premiums. When we do a deal for a country like that, someone else, the UK, the US, Germany, Japan, is undoubtedly going to be paying the premium. But for what we would call middle-income countries, even they obviously are budget-constrained, and if they have a $30 million budget line item 1 year to pay for disaster risk recovery, and they're looking at, we could use that to help build a seawall, or we can buy insurance for a really significant event that will breach that seawall anyway, which should we do? It's reasonable for them to say, let's put this into something that will definitely happen, like the seawall, as opposed to something where we may pay the $30 million and there won't be a payout. So that's definitely our biggest constraint. Now, once we get over that constraint, we can bring deals to the market. I say we have two big constraints. One is cost. It still costs us a lot of transaction cost to do one of these transactions. I would say a typical deal is maybe a $200 million placement. And in terms of transaction costs, that's probably going to be $2 million of upfront transaction costs. Now, that is a lot for a government to look at paying for a transaction. And it's shocking to them because all of these governments issue government bonds. And, of course, this is nothing like a government bond, but they still compare the costs. And they still say this is too high. So this is where what you're talking about, fintech. There has to be where we're going, because we can't be doing this endlessly, paying $2 million. I mean, no disrespect to the lawyers in this room. And I'm sure the lawyers, when all the other costs come out, the lawyers will still find a way to get their money. So I don't
mention the brokers.
Yes, yeah. And the brokers, you'll get your money too. We're not going to disintermediate anybody, but we're going to somehow not pay costs anymore. So cost is a huge issue. And the final constraint we have, which is directly relevant to you folks, or those of you who are investors in this room, is flexibility. When we come with if we're going to come with a Pakistan flood deal, I mean, we won't do it right now, but if we come with a Pakistan flood deal, it may not look exactly like a Florida wind deal in terms of modeling. Now, we're not going to ask you to subsidize us, but so we're not going to say just take unmodeled risk and hope for the best. We will do everything we can to put that in a package that works for you modeling-wise. But it may not. Maybe there's different currency risks involved. Maybe we need a different maturity than you're comfortable with. And we think we're bringing you something very valuable, the investor community, something very valuable. We'd be bringing you highly diversifying risk in a absolutely secure package, because again, it's the World Bank that are issuing these bonds. We're insuring the government. We're taking any premium risk, and we're issuing the bond as a AAA. So we think we're providing the market something extraordinarily valuable. And so we'd always ask for you to work with us and have some flexibility, because we often hear, when we speak to investors on sort of theoretical basis about our deals in the future, we hear expressions of massive flexibility. We'll take any modeling agent. We will take any maturity. We can take foreign currency. But then when we bring a deal, a lot of that flexibility kind of seems to disappear a bit, and it seems to be much more, it's not really, you know, what we like. So that's another constraint where I think we would ask for your help and working with us to be able to take, if you want that diversifying risk, you know, think about a more, you know, being maximally flexible while at the same time not, you know, not taking undue risk. We understand you have fiduciary obligations, but think about flexibilities you can build into your approach.
So Niels, Lorenzo, you're the two up here. Lucky for you, I'm going to put you on the
spot.
Well,
it's challenging, right? In fact, I don't think Michael has ever heard from us that we are that flexible. So that's for sure one of the constraints we have, right? And I hear him. I mean, I've worked with the World Bank. I've known them for a long time, and I really appreciate what they try to do. I've been on the structuring side, but then, as you mentioned, we have a fiduciary duty, right, to our investors. So we can't just experiment or take something if we think that we don't perfectly understand it. I think that's, you know, ultimately every penny counts. And so obviously the ability to get involved on the structuring side or understand how to improve the structure obviously helps. But at the same time, the level of due diligence that you do on each deal is always the same. And, you know, we discussed also in the past about the ticket size, right? I mean, the capacity in the market, which obviously fluctuates over time, also not depending on us, but the wider markets and the volatility out there. And it's always, tricky, because irrespective, you know, one of the comments Michael made was, well, you know, you can spend an hour with an investor on a due diligence and you receive only $1 million. Now, it's not our case. Usually we're bigger than that. Yeah. But obviously, you know, every penny counts. And so what we can do to improve it, obviously, communication is key. And now the cat bond being a 144A is always tricky, you know, to be able to actually disclose everything before you go out to market. But obviously, you involve a number of structuring agents that are very experienced and know what investors are looking for. And in the old days, I used to work in parallel on a cat swap and private deals so that I could, get more feedback for more capacity providers in an independent way without breaching any regulatory environment. So that also helps for sure. But from an ESG perspective, there is an education that we're bringing to investors as well in terms of supporting these type of deals that maybe are not easy to model, or they're not easy to, or they're not as comparable as the U.S. wind risk. However, it's the usual chicken and egg between scalability, availability of deals, and invest. Now, I'm confident that we will see more investors approaching us looking for this type of deals, which really tick the box for ESG. I'm positive by nature, but I'm very hopeful that we'll find those investors.
I'm sure we will find them. And you just mentioned something which is I think critical, the fiduciary duty we have as asset managers. And I think it's also, it's not only that, it's also meeting the investors' expectations. And I think if this is the case, then there are really many interested investors who are looking for these type of impact-orientated investments. But based on our experience and our discussions which we have with potential investors, is very clear. They are looking for, so they're not philanthropists, they want to make money. and they want to get their money back, very likely. And so that's something which we have to meet. And the better the client or the investor experience is with such investments, the better or the more assets will be there in the future. And I think this is something which we should work on jointly. But it's also a question, what kind of pocket do we have? Is this something which we just buy for in an existing product, or is it something which is dedicated for these type of questions? And probably this is the way to go, since there are many impact investors in the globe, deep pockets, but it has to be in line with the expectations. That's what we think, and that's the expectations we have.
So Niels, I want to go back to comments you made earlier around technology.
Yeah.
There are several climate tech, insure tech startups who are thinking about different technology for triggers.
Yeah.
How have each of you thought about that at your organizations?
Yeah, we are watching this very closely. So we are not a fintech, but we at 12, we are also working on an insurtech growth fund, so not venture. So we believe that this is something which will help overall closing the protection gap also with these fintechs. And we also see that there are many ideas around which probably won't fly. This is normal, but there are many great ideas, and they are based on digital models, based on gaps caused by climate change. What I see is that the business models are probably different. They are probably more driven, especially if it comes to parametric solutions, by more investment banking or traditional, let's say, asset management skills and thoughts, and less by reinsurance models. And this combined with digital models could probably a way to be successful. But I haven't seen really this kind of top fintech which will make it. There are some great ideas around. But I think one issue also there is, how do I get to the deals? It's great to have a nice digital platform and raise here 2 million and there 2 million. It's great, but it doesn't really turn the needle, and it's not for us interesting. I think this is something which we have to see, but there is potential. But also, a revolution is more successful if it comes as an evolution. And this is probably also the case for your ideas about your parametric solutions. If it's too new, too fresh, then probably many of our investors, pension funds, which have to go through their boards, that need to get the approval, they're probably not too keen. So probably also from the investor side, we are going probably in a different direction.
Yeah, I mean, I've got similar feedback here. Obviously, you know, we are a dedicated ILS manager. You know, we keep an eye on the evolution of the market. You know, we look at it with, do we think it's disruptive? Probably not yet. I think, you know, we look at threat and opportunities as part of our analysis. You know, we usually have a strategic offsite where we bring all the ideas, what's happening in the market, thinking where should we actually focus our time. You know, we are 30 people, you know, so we need to look at within 1 year what we can achieve. And we have so many different products. I mean, I think we have around now 17 strategies, so there is a lot already to distribute and sell. And then obviously the fintech requires a lot of investments as well. There is a lot of private equity money that came into the space to push that. We don't have private equity investors, so it's a, you know, different type of play. It will definitely help the development of the market. We keep an eye on it, but you know, I always say, stick to what you know and try to deliver your returns, right? That's really what we're aiming for.
Yeah, I guess from what I've seen, digitization works best generally in finance when you have a highly standardized product. You have a contract that you can trade. Now that could work really well for us in one of our more, what we would call middle income country, a developing country, but more developed, where maybe there is not only the sovereign government looking for insurance, there could be a whole set of insurance companies there, or even companies with just exposed facilities who could want to trade a standardized contract, like a Mexico. Let's say there was a Mexican parametric earthquake contract that traded on a digital exchange, which the sovereign could also use. That I could see as being extremely beneficial, because then, you know, rather than having to do their own 2 million of transaction costs, they can just buy this tradable contract. So I see that as very valuable. Now, we don't have that yet in our country. We have most of the places we're working, we have one buyer who wants to buy this parametric insurance. It's the government, and they want to do it on some sort of bespoke basis. So at that point, when we talk to most people who run digital exchanges, they'll probably tell us, yeah, we can create a contract for you. But if we're creating our own contract and it's referring, there's hyperlinks to just as long legal documentation as we're doing now, I'm not sure how much that helps us, because I don't think the trading of, you folks could correct me, but I don't think the trading of cap bonds right now, other than the fact they don't trade very much, is such a problem that digitization is going to suddenly create all kinds of new liquidity. So I think it's really, for us, it's does it save money at the primary issuance point? And right now, when we have sort of one buyer in the country looking for bespoke protection, I don't think it saves us. From what I've seen, it doesn't save us any money yet. But I mean, I hope by the time you know, the younger people in my team are doing this, I should be retired, but by the time the younger people in my team are doing this, there's got to be digital solutions that we're working on. It must be, because otherwise we're just putting our heads in the sand. So I think that will happen, but it just doesn't save us enough money yet on the primary issue.
And also, as you said, the origination is really tricky, right? Yeah. I mean, you already struggle to discuss to one team, and then the government changes, and then you have to convince someone else, and you work for the World Bank. Imagine, you know, a fintech that needs to feed, you know, opportunities for it.
So what's reflected to me in the different responses you each gave is how broad the opportunity is in insurtech or fintech. Michael talks about transaction and how we actually transact. Neil's kind of touched on triggers and technology use for triggers. And Lorenzo talks about like direct investment into technology. So I think it's pretty broad, the different ways that it can be applied, and definitely an area where we're all still working it out. So on origination then, because that's come up a few times as kind of a catalyst to unlock this, like Niels and Lorenzo, what's your wish list for someone like Michael?
Well, multiple deals, you know, covering multiple perils that can be easily modeled. I mean, well, Michael knows. I mean, I'm sure he has, I think it's very easy. I mean, it's the certainty on the pipeline would really help. I mean, when you talk to investors, if you really want to deliver a portfolio for, low-income or middle-income countries, just to show that actually you're doing something which is socially responsible, then you also need to basically. And I know that his frustration, on the other hand, is hearing people say we have plenty of capacity, and then when he wants to launch, he doesn't find the money he's looking for. So that's a bit of a chicken and egg. That's why, I would love to, and we discussed that in the past, I would like to sit at the table and say, look, I have an investor here, $200 million. Can we do 10 deals just to provide some diversification within this portfolio? But I'm also familiar with the hurdles that he faces. So
I think what you just said, having more deals, better diversified, to be able to build a portfolio, this is, I think, critical. And then if the modeling and the pricing and the risk is right, then I think there's huge potential. So copy your wish list, probably. However,
I forgot the premium. But
yeah, the premium, yes.
The premium is
what important. And inflation and climate change, impact, whatever. So, but point is I think if there were more world banks with different deals, and not only supported by the World Bank, but also by the industry, closing gaps in developing countries, but also in other areas, I think this is something which is needed. So it's not this kind of, or just the World Bank. There are other institutions, we know it. But I think the broader it is and the more normal it is to have these type of products, the easier it is to build portfolios and to create this kind of traction.
And we also need to maintain that floating rate that the World Bank delivers for its paper for the collateral. That's also very useful. So I'm just thinking about the economics
since
of the
I
deal
asked,
here.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think we're probably, are we out of time? All right. No time for questions. Yeah, sorry. Sorry, we went on too long. Thank you all very much, and thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thank you.